following interview with James Schlesinger by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on May 15, 1986. The interview is part of a joint project by the Columbia University Oral History Research Office and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
How was it you came to work for the Nixon administration in 1969? What brought you into the administration?
That's a personal question. It's a question of my motivation at the time. I was working for the Rand Corporation. I had been in an advisory position. I've been in advisory positions to various government agencies. And I thought that it would be interesting for a while to be on the policy making side as opposed to the advisory side. I was recommended to Mr. Mayo, then designate to run the Bureau of the Budget by various people. He offered me the job of assistant to director of the BOD with responsibilities for national security.
That became the OMB shortly thereafter.
It became under study. It became the OMB 17 months into the Nixon administration.
How long were you at the Bureau of the Budget and then OMB?
I was there approximately 2 years.
And there you went to?
I went to the Atomic Energy Commission as chairman in the summer of 1971. So I stayed on at the BOD OMB for, I guess it's close to 30 months.
Now, in early 1973, you left the Atomic Energy Commission chairmanship and became director of Central Intelligence.
That's right.
Now, why did Nixon appoint you to that post? What were the reasons?
Well, I think that's a question that you better ask Mr. Nixon.
Yeah.
Early in the administration, I had, I had responsibility for the national security area, I was urged by the president to, Mr. Mayo was urged by the president and specifying that I would do the study on the, a study on reducing outlays for the intelligence community. The president had been approached by George Mahon, who was then chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the House, who said that expenditures on intelligence were simply getting out of hand. He at that time mentioned the number of $5 billion. As you recall, we were reducing the Department of Defense, and the intelligence budget is buried in the Department of Defense. As the overall DOD budget came down, it was essential to reduce intelligence outlays, and in addition, both Mahon and the president felt that we were spending too much on intelligence anyhow. So the president came into it from the outset with the view that intelligence expenditures should be reduced. In addition to that, as you may know, Mr. Nixon was not particularly fond of the Central Intelligence Agency, and I believe that that is reflected in his judgments at the time. He had the view, I am told, that the CIA discussions of the missile gap had cost him the election in 1960. Whether or not, and to whatever extent he may have had that view, the fact of the matter was that he really was not very fond of the Central Intelligence Agency and of many of the senior personnel at the agency. How did he come to appoint me? Once Mr. Schultz came in as director of the OMB, he talked to Nixon, and Nixon talked again about the need for an intelligence study. It was then that I turned out the study, now known as the Schlesinger Report, that described the alternatives that the president had for restructuring of the intelligence community. I then more or less disappeared to the Atomic Energy Commission. But after the election of 1972, Nixon and his senior advisors were busily emptying out personnel who had served in the first term. And as you recall, he requested a resignation letter from everybody. I was called up to Camp David sometime in December of 72, and the president and Haldeman and Ehrlichman, I think, were there and indicated that the president wanted me to go to the CIA. I was perfectly happy at the AEC, and I urged them not to move Mr. Helms out. But they listened politely, but paid no further attention to my remarks. A few days later, it became clear that they treated the prior conversation about my probable move to the CIA as a fait accompli.
Now, when you were at CIA, who were the people who advised you on questions that were involved Iran? For example, the Kurdish question. What kind of people did you rely upon for policy advice?
Well, I did not need to rely on policy advice at that time. We had an ongoing operation. The attitude of the Iraqi government at that time was distinctly hostile to the United States, and the attitude of the Iranian government was quite friendly. I inherited a policy, and therefore it did not seem to me essential to analyze the merits of a policy that was already in place. As you may know, I only spent 4 months at the CIA, and between the breaking in process and the Watergate problem that busted over the agency, that there was not a great deal of time to reflect on external activities.
Mm-hmm. So you just continued the Kurdish operation, basically, while you were there for the 6 months?
Well, I'm not sure I want to confirm or deny.
Okay. Let me go on to something else. Maybe more general questions about the U.S. and Iran during the 70s as a whole. Maybe that gets back to CIA for a second. What was the overall importance of Iran to U.S. foreign policy goals during the Nixon and Ford administrations?
Well, I think that there was some difference in tone between the two. I think that Mr. Nixon and the Shah had a personal relationship and a degree of warmth that was not true of the Ford-Shah relationship. President Ford tended to follow the commitments of his predecessor and the advice of Secretary Kissinger, but I don't think that the degree of commitment was there, and consequently some of the things to which we had committed ourselves during the Nixon years, those commitments might not have been made in the 4 years. One can never tell. The overall relationship during that period, obliterating differences between the two, was one of great closeness. probably excessive closeness, not only from the standpoint of the United States, but probably from the standpoint of the well-being of the Shah and Iran both. The closeness was in part an outgrowth of the public atmosphere in the United States. And our involvement in the Vietnam War, which, as you know, continued in diminuendo until 1975, although U.S. forces were effectively withdrawn after 73, the public opposition to the war was, to say the least, substantial. And as a result, and the congressional opposition as well, and as a result, the possibility of the United States using its own military resources for the protection of the region of the Persian Gulf, given public and congressional attitudes, were regarded as low. What is referred to as the Nixon Doctrine of relying on the Shah and other regional powers was not so much a decision taken as an ideal outcome, but driven by the constraints that were established during the Korean War period. Therefore, you had the Vietnam War. I should have said Vietnam War. The Vietnam War was established constraints. There was the belief that we had to create a new security structure in the region of the Persian Gulf. The British indicated that they were in the process of withdrawing. And there was this intimate relationship between the President, President Nixon, and the Shah. President Nixon had a failing that he tended to believe those who were close to him emotionally had greater strength and capability than was actually the case, and the Shah certainly fell under that rubric. We overloaded the Shah in terms of putting him in a position that was greater than his resources, his real resources, could bear. We overloaded the Shah, too, in my judgment, in calling upon him to perform missions that resulted in reinforcing his own estimate of his own importance. But that was a reflection, as I say, of the constraints on the ability of the United States to replace the British as the British withdrew from the region. A good deal of wishful thinking about how much the Shah could do as the regional protector, and the personal relationship between Nixon and the Shah.
What accounted for this relationship?
Now, I should say one other thing. As a result of this relationship, we made commitments to the Shah that were open-ended commitments. Those commitments antedated my involvement in the problem and go back to, I think, the meetings at Persepolis and other places in which the president, in effect, said that the Shah could not only rely on the United States, whatever he wanted, he could have. That was the background.
Now, how do policymakers generally define the U.S. interest in Iran in this period?
I don't know that they're very explicit in defining it. I think that it filtered down from the commitments that Nixon and Kissinger had made in the early days of the administration. To the extent that it was defined, it wasn't defined all that well. The role of the Shah was of the principal U.S. ally and as the strong man of the Gulf. serving as a proxy, as it were, for American power. But that was rather ill-defined, and needless to say, while that was the view at the top, many of the functionaries in the government didn't necessarily subscribe to it, most particularly the people in the Department of Defense.
That's what you mean to say. When people look at Iran as a country in that area, what was the importance assigned to it? Why was it seen as important?
It was seen as important for a number of reasons. The first reason was the real estate that it occupied. Going back to the 1950s and Secretary Dulles' attempt to establish what was the short-lived Baghdad Pact that became CENTO, the Shah was the centerpiece, as it were, of CENTO. That was the northern tier. With the passage of the years, the northern tier grew in importance. Why did it grow in importance? When it was set up, the dependency of the industrial world on the oil resources of the Persian Gulf were limited. With each passing year, more or less, that dependency grew so that the Persian Gulf oil resources have become critical to the industrial world and to the rest. And for that reason, the tier, which was served as a kind of band, presumably keeping the Soviets from penetrating southward to reach those oil resources, to say nothing of the historic interest in the warm water ports, as expressed at least by legend from the time of Peter the Great, became more and more important. I don't think that at the time of the Baghdad Pact it was fully appreciated. I know it wasn't fully appreciated how important the Persian Gulf is to become. So the first thing is the real estate, where it was located. The second thing was the role of the Shah in CENTO. The Shah was, as it were, an unencumbered U.S. ally. After the price revolution of 1973, he was not only an ally, but he was an ally with lots of cash to spend and one who had a certain authority with regard to the oil price that had become critical. And finally, he was a source of military power that could be, finally and not least, a source of military power that was believed to be capable of serving as a stabilizing presence in the region, outside of the role of the northern tier as a band to prevent Soviet movement southward. It was also going to serve to stabilize the Gulf itself, as the Dhofar involvement suggested.
A question about the CIA period. But maybe if you can answer them, you can answer them. If you can't, well, just go on. But in the 50s and early 60s, the CIA station chief in Tehran generally had a fairly close working relationship with the Shah. Was this something that was still the case in the early 70s, this kind of close relationship on a working basis?
It would be my impression, and I should not say that it's more than that, that had ceased, that the Shah had gradually become more elevated, and that he would dealt increasingly with the ambassador, and it was natural for an ambassador, not to specify any particular one, to want those kinds of discussions to go through the ambassador rather than through the station chief. And then, of course, when Mr. Helms became ambassador, he was, he could be regarded as one who was knowledgeable about the functions of a station chief, and one might say he was a glorified and elevated station chief. So I don't think that the relationship would have survived in that period. I have no recollection of any such close involvement between the Shah and others. The Shah, as you may know, became to some extent increasingly remote as the years passed.
Now, in the 60s and early 70s, through the 70s, the agency used Iran as a listening post on Soviet missile tests. Now, it's been alleged that during the 60s, press later, it's not clear to me, that the...
Well, that's your statement.
Yeah,
that's right. Listening post.
Yeah, right. It's been alleged the CIA agreed not to spy on the Shah in order to get use of these sites for listening on missile tests. Was there anything to those allegations that you can speak on?
I couldn't comment on that.
Another question, this might be one you can. At the time you were CIA director, did the agency do much monitoring of social and political conditions inside Iran? Did you get a sense of the social and political conditions in the country from reports that you read?
No, Iran was not. I did not, I had enough to do, and Iran was not at the top of our priority list. In general, the attitude within the agency was, I think, that you had, as ambassador there, a man who was quite knowledgeable about such matters, and sense of things probably was good enough. I think that there may have been some tendency for the agency to grow a little complacent with a former director as the ambassador.
Well, during this period, early to mid-70s, were there any particular concerns at all about the stability of the Shah's rule in Iran? People assessed
in the early and mid 70s?
Through the mid 70s.
Well, I had considerable concerns about it. And I expressed them repeatedly. They were not concerns that went to the intelligence data, they were concerns that reflected a general analysis of the kinds of forces that were at work in Iran. I urged the Shah, the first time I met him, to use his resources prudently rather than to squandering them on a diverse set of military hardware. And a principal reason that I gave was the lack of a substantial body of trained technicians inside of the country. And to the extent that he acquired complex military hardware and many models of it, he established logistical requirements that would have gradually absorbed more and more of those trained personnel, so that fewer and fewer were available for the normal civilian activities of the society. There is that general observation. I was quite concerned about it, that the heedless growth of the armed services would result in an excessive drawing away of specific resources, in this case, trained technicians. I was not worried about the cash, the overall monetary requirements, but its direct impact on the availability of trained people. It seemed to me that the Shah's notions of modernizing the country in particular, that the unplanned growth of the armed services would defeat some of those schemes. That was a general thought. As it turned out, it was more accurate than ever I thought at the time. The other point that I should make is that a simple historical point made by every historian since de Tocqueville which is the time of transformation of these societies, that they become particularly unstable, that as you root up people, move them from traditional settings and from traditional occupations into new occupations, and particularly if there is a growth of real income that might be interrupted, that the society is far more vulnerable than when it is functioning as a traditional society. That's sort of a general observation. One was worried about that on, in a general way, but of course general worries tend to be overtaken by specific worries, and the point that I emphasized more than anything else was the very limited number of trained people in the country and the desirability of not allowing them to be engrossed, as it were, by the military establishment. However, the Shah, I didn't never mentioned the latter point about the Tocqueville and so on to the Shah, because that was the kind of thing that is likely to have irritated him, and I felt the irritation was unnecessary, but I stressed what was the substantive point about trained people. It did not, it affected his course of action somewhat, but not significantly, as we can see in retrospect.
When you started out at the CIA, you know, in the 4 months you were there, did Henry Kissinger discuss to you, with you, the rationale for the support of the Kurdish insurgency in Iraq?
As I indicated earlier, this was not a high priority item, and I only spent about 4 months at the agency in total. My recollection now, somewhat obscure, is that indeed Henry did discuss this briefly as one of the things that we were doing. As you may recall, the government of Iraq was highly antagonistic at the time. My recollection is that this was discussed more in terms of creating a problem for the Iraqi regime than it was a in terms of support for the Shah's ambitions. That would seem to be an appropriate emphasis for him to make. I tended to, although I supported the Shah, I tended to be a little bit more skeptical about the hopes of the administration for the role that the Shah might play, and a little more skeptical about the Shah's ambitions than some of the other members of the administration. That is not to imply that I was as a critic. It was merely that in relative standing I was far more cautious.
Critical support. It's been alleged that Kissinger and Nixon agreed to the Shah's request for this operation, if this op was in 72, but only he insisted that they support the operation if he was to play the role of John Darn in the Gulf. Is there some quid pro quo that you know about?
I do not know of that.
Yeah.
However, it is quite plausible to me. As you may know, our role was a supportive role. I think that he wanted, that the Shah eagerly wanted the prestige of the United States involved, the backing of the United States, but he was less concerned about the quantitative support. And that he was in a position, given the overall role that we wanted him to play, to demand a quid pro quo. So, while I cannot speak to that myself, and others presumably can, it strikes me as more than plausible.
In July 73, I think, you became Secretary of Defense.
I had served, as indicated, as Secretary of Defense basically from April and May on. I was. My final confirmation by the Senate was held up for some months by Senator Proxmire, But from mid-May on, I was down at the Pentagon most of the time, and with the concurrence of the Armed Services Committee, while my confirmation was pending, I went to the NATO meetings in Europe as de facto Secretary of Defense with the role of Special Presidential Envoy. And if you, therefore, it's quite true that I became formally Secretary of Defense in July, but I had served as Secretary of Defense de facto for some months prior to it.
What accounted for this quick transition from CIA to the Pentagon? What decisions have been made?
Well, I can't speak to that. Once again, you ought to speak to Nixon himself. Elliot Richardson was Secretary of Defense. He wanted Elliot Over as Attorney General for reasons relating to Watergate, and I forget the precise details at this time. I think that Kleindienstern he replaced?
Shortly, yeah. Yeah. Okay, a little bit, yeah.
I think that, of course, Kleindienstern had gotten into a peck of trouble, and that created something of a stain on the Department of Justice, and that Elliot Richardson's reputation was such that he could remove that stain. Therefore, they moved Richardson as quickly as they could, and I was the logical choice within the administration.
Okay. Now, when you became Secretary of Defense, had you been briefed or told about the substance of the meetings that Nixon and Kissinger held with the Shah in May of 72 in terms of arms sales decisions? Were you informed, or did you read about them in documents?
I don't recall that I had any direct briefings. As one reflects on it, there were kind of hints at this and that, but there was no documentation. It became clear to me over the period ahead that the relationship was very deep, but no, I cannot recall any explanation of the degree of commitment, and indeed I have not to this day had it confirmed from the participants that those commitments were made, that you can have anything you wanted. I did not at that time believe that such deep commitments had been made, although I understood that that we were supposed in general to support the Shah, because I resisted certain sales, certain commitments by the United States, which I didn't think were in our interest, and sometimes were not in the Shah's interest. And on some of them, I just got overruled.
What sales were these? Do you recall the details?
Well, I think that with regard to aircraft, I was allowed to attempt to dissuade the Shah from acquiring certain aircraft. Indeed, ultimately, I persuaded him that he ought not to buy both the F-14 and the F-15. Simply because with forces that small, he should not have two long and complex logistics trains, once again going back to my concern about trained manpower. Then there was the case of the TOW missile, which I got to be critical because the Shah wanted to put a plant in country for the production of the TOW, and I was hesitant to allow the technology to produce the TOW to go outside of the country. And I dragged my feet on that. If effect, but when the decision was made, the decision was, yes, indeed, we were going to go with the Shah's request. Once again, I was permitted to attempt to dissuade the Shah, but if the Shah insisted, he won.
Did he in this case?
I beg pardon?
Did he in this case of the Tso?
He did indeed in the case of the Tso. And I noticed all of that, but I did not know that he had been, I still did not know, or I've never been informed that whatever he wanted, he could have, as the statements about the Persepolis conference suggest. I've never asked Nixon about that at the time or subsequently, whether or not that commitment was as deep as it was.
So, in effect, Iranian.
There was, of course, negotiations on all sorts of things, Bell helicopters, and so forth. But I thought my general fear was the leakage of high technology items into a region in which one could not predict the future with certainty. That's not to say I expected the Shah to be overthrown, but I thought that the instabilities in the region were such that one should not encourage the export of high technology. Should not encourage the export of the capability to produce high technology items. That was what was different about the Tso plant. Now, we were engaged in selling the Shah high technology items, and one might worry about that too, but it was less worrisome than the provision of the capability to produce. As I say, I raise these questions, and each of these cases, my arguments tended to receive relatively short shrift, from which one might conclude that there had been a prior commitment, but I was never told about it.
These were discussions with Kissinger, NSC in meetings. You made these objections at NSC meetings?
No, they were all private discussions. Meetings for lunch and that sort of thing.
Kissinger and yeah. Others. Okay. So you're saying effectively.
By that time, Nixon was reasonably fully absorbed with the Watergate problem. And these kinds of things were beneath his tension level, by and large. The Shah came here, as I recall it, in the summer of 73. September of 73, was it? Or
that's right, I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, I think it was September 73. It may have been 74, but it was, I think, shortly after I became Secretary of Defense, and I pressed him to on some of these points that I've previously mentioned about the importance of maintaining a balanced military force, not too heavily involved in procurement. That was toward the end of the period in which Nixon was reasonably fully engaged with government before he became inundated by the Watergate affair.
Before I ask about that visit to the Shah, I have a few general questions about the arms sales and their implications. Now, was there much concern in DOD or other agencies the Iranian arms buildup might aggravate a regional arms race and lead to further instability in the region? Was that considered as a problem or a future possible problem?
I think that was used as from time to time as an argument within the Pentagon, but it was only an argument. The Pentagon is not given either institutionally or emotionally to deep and excessive neuroses about the arms races, regional or otherwise. And I think that, of course, tends to be a failing. It was justified, probably, in this case, to a considerable extent by the attitudes taken by the Iraqis. The fact that our arming of Iran tended to reinforce the inclination of the Iraqis to run to the Soviet Union, however, was not given a great deal of weight. I think in these matters that they're that one point passes a point of no return, as it were. And that is a that is the appropriate kind of question to raise before one develops an extensive arms relationship. Once one's engaged in the other party in that arms race, the Iraqis in this case, have turned to the Soviets as suppliers, the tendency is for that relationship between the third party and the Soviets to obliterate other concerns. And that relationship tends to justify thereafter arms sales.
Right. Now, some students of arms sales have suggested that by making Iran more dependent upon U.S. high technology weapons, Nixon and Ford administrations hope to be in a better position to influence the Shah's political military moves in the region through a process of dependence.
That's the kind of academic suggestion. It's reflection of the academic capacity to see logical relationships and infer from a logical relationship that it may have been a principal motivation. No, the fact of the matter is that we had an intimate relationship with the Shah, and that the notion of using arms sales as a way of high technology arms sales and make it dependency as a way of making him more responsive was pretty far off. What is true and is generally true about arms sales is the belief that the arms relationship, not necessarily involving high technology, breeds an intimacy that is politically useful. And that certainly applied in this case, as it does in almost any case that I can think of offhand. The Shah, providing the arms for the Shah, brought him closer to the United States and therefore more responsive to our suggestions. But it wasn't a dependency on high technology items. That's carrying logic too far.
Now, you said a few minutes ago, the same month you officially became Secretary of Defense, the Shah visited Washington, D.C. Can you recall the general purposes of this visit to the district?
I don't recall the general purposes of the thing. It was other than it was the continuation of the relationship that had been engendered in the early years of the Nixon administration, and a renewal of vows, as it were, a new renewal of marital vows. The Shah tended to develop his strategic hypotheses, most of which involved the Soviets and destroying Pakistan by Soviet subordination of the Baluchis and Pushtuns. It was his belief that the Soviets were going to move against Afghanistan as politically a fact that became much more true some years later, at the time that Daoud was overthrown. But Daoud was regarded by the Shah as pretty much a Soviet tool. That's not correct, but he pretty much regarded it in that light. The dismemberment of Pakistan was his principal concern and its relationship for the stability of the region as a whole, and particularly of Iran itself. The Shah, as you may know, since he was an absolute monarch, tended to spin out these theories in Tehran, and as he did so, he was surrounded by a group of people who say, "Oh, how wise you are, Your Majesty, how insightful." And so he tended to be unchecked, as it were, in the development of his strategic views, some of which was soundly based, but some of which became pretty fanciful.
Continue your train of thought, or
has it? I completed that particular.
Okay. Was this the first time you had met the Shah?
Yes, indeed.
What were your impressions of the Shah?
My impressions of the Shah at the time was a man of a high degree of apparent self-assurance, underscore the apparent. As I mentioned a moment ago, he tended to be unchecked within his own country and therefore to expect agreement. But knowing something of his history as a younger man, I was concerned with the apparentness, as it were, of the self-assurance. He did not strike me as an immensely tenacious person, as opposed to one who was used to getting his own way and had the appearance, therefore, of self-confidence for that reason. He had not been proved, as it were, under adversity. Much had been handed to him. In addition to that, I was reasonably impressed with his articulateness, with his general intelligence, with his ability to formulate and express his views. Some of those views tended to get a little far-fetched. He had developed some grandiose notions about the future of Iran, much of which were captured by Miss Falachi, or whatever her name was, in the interview, in which he was going to catch up and surpass West Germany and France in a decade's time or something like that. That's the fanciful part of the Shah. And he tended to be carried away on these flights of fancy. Unfortunately, there was nobody inside of his country that could really say, Your Majesty, you'd better think that one over again. They tended to be yes men, and he tended to select people who were yes men. That became increasingly clear. One was impressed, as I recall it, with his role as absolute monarch. It tended to be so different from the comportment of senior officials in a democratic society who, however overwhelmed they are with their own importance or self-confidence, tends to be much more reasoned in expressing themselves.
He was in Washington. Did you have meetings with him?
Yes, he came to the Pentagon.
Yes. You discussed the arms sales issues, you mentioned that.
We discussed that. Generally speaking, it was an exposition. He was primarily concerned with expressing his strategic judgments, and I was eager to express my concern about the possible wastage of resources. It was under those circumstances that I suggested that he put together a staff so that he could monitor the balance of expenditures so that his armed forces were capable of fighting rather than merely acquiring weaponry, which, as I recall, He agreed that you did more than acquiesce, but I'm not sure that he embraced the notion in its entirety on the spot.
I've been doing these meetings in July. There were discussions of petroleum policy with the Shah. Did you participate in those talks?
I do not recall so doing. As you'll recall, this was some months before the Arab oil embargo, before the Yom Kippur War. I know that there were those discussions. The Shah did mention to me his desire to sell directly to the United States and to have, in effect, a guaranteed market here so that he could move more oil, so he could get more returns and thereby play an even better role in terms of stabilizing the Gulf. But it was a very brief set of comments. He pressed that quite hard with Secretary Kissinger, and I'm certain he pressed it with Nixon as well.
So I thought you were making assurances about the stability of supply. Is that what he was doing in a way?
He was, making such assurances, but he was talking more about the mutual advantages in terms of trade, as it were. That he was a reliable friend of the United States. There was not an insinuation, I don't think, that the Saudis might cut us off just 4 months later, or 3 months later. He offered to provide all the oil, at one point or another during this period, to provide all the oil that the United States might want at some guaranteed price, which was above the market price, as I recall. Kissinger has repeatedly joked in subsequent years that Kissinger, was such a good businessman that when the Shah offered him a guaranteed supply of oil at $5 a barrel, that he turned him down. This was by the time the price of oil had gone to $35 a barrel. That was Kissinger's humor, because obviously if the market had changed, the Shah was not going to buy by any $5 guaranteed price. But Kissinger's jokes about these matters, I think, reflect the nature of the conversations with the Shah. As needless to say, it was not regarded as appropriate for the United States government to enter into a commercial relationship with the Shah, and that the decision of where to lift oil was going to be left to the marketplace, to the major oil importing companies. That is not necessarily what the Shah wanted to hear, because he had had enough experience with those companies and he didn't think that they were in existence to serve his purposes. He was quite right about that.
At these meetings, were there any decisions made about arms sales, if you recall? Was it always done in general terms? Did any decisions come out of the meetings?
No. In fact, the principal issue was the F-14 and the F-15. The Shah indicated he wanted both of them. I urged him not to establish two complicated logistical trains for two separate weapon systems, that he choose between the two. I think I said that if it were my choice, that I would choose the F-15. Uh, Shaw was pretty well committed to the F-14. It turned out he started to order the F-14 thereafter. He never did get around, whether persuaded by my comments or not, to order the F-15, which he had originally intended to do, for which I got into considerable hot water with the Missouri delegation, and Senator Symington chided me, or more than chided me, during my appearances before the Armed Services Committee. I took the simple view from the first that it was that arms sales were not intended to fatten up the U.S. balance of payments, that they were not intended to satisfy the military services by achieving lower unit costs or the activities of particular firms in particular states or districts. That was not a universally popular view. But I think that it was a sensible view in general, but it was particularly sensible given the climate of the time and widespread view in public opinion that we ought not to be fostering either arms races or arms sales merely for the commercial motives.
Well, I had a sense that the Navy Air Force Procurement Bureaus were keenly interested in selling.
Absolutely, that's what I just hinted at when I said the desire of the services to lower per unit costs. I dealt with that, as a matter of fact. I think I dealt with it. I certainly dealt with it conceptually by telling the services that they were not going to benefit by arms sales in terms of their budgetary outcomes, that to the extent that they successfully sold a package to a country, that I was going to reduce the aggregate for that service by the reduction in the cost of that weapon system to the service. I wanted to remove the incentive to the individual services to go around the world hawking arms. And I think that I certainly weakened that incentive as an economic incentive. There's a good deal of service pride and the tendency amongst the services were to push their weapon systems for reasons beyond economic. But I hope to pull away the budgetary incentives. And I gave instructions early on that there was to be no deliberate hawking of weapon systems, of the whetting of appetites for potentially recipient countries, that we as a country should neither sell weapons simply for balance of payments reasons, nor should we sell weapons unless there was a good military reason. Now, from time to time, we would have to respond to the desires of potential recipients, but we should not be there whetting their appetites. I think that position of mine may have had some influence, but basically the services continued in the game of whetting appetites.
Well, so difficult to control, I would imagine.
Well, it's very difficult to control. I think that I did much of what one can do simply by taking away the budgetary incentive, and to the extent that I told the Navy directly that they were not going to benefit in a budgetary sense from the sale of the F-14, and I also told them that they were to sell the weapon system at a price that redeemed some of the R&D costs that had gone into the weapon system. The Navy in that case, but the services generally would fight that off because it raised the price and therefore diminished the prospect of sales. They were interested very much in reducing the out-of-pocket cost. They weren't worried in past history like R&D.
According to a report issued in 1976 by the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, the report on arms sales in Iran, it suggested that the various armed services procurement bureaus were in such intense competition for selling weapons in league with the contractors that there was a state of near anarchy within the Pentagon in terms of effective control over arms sales.
I don't know where they got that. I don't think that there was anarchy. That was the kind of thing that was being pumped up at the time by critics on Capitol Hill who, as I indicated a few moments ago, were quite concerned about arms sales in general and the arms race and any sales by the United States. That kind of assertion about anarchy in the Pentagon, I think, was just wholly wrong. Now, what is true, of course, is that there was a great deal of competition within the Pentagon, and that to some extent that was accepted. It certainly had been encouraged by previous secretaries of defense. As you remember, Secretary McNamara had told Kennedy that he was going to solve the American balance of payments problems insofar as the defense budget was concerned by foreign sales. And when he decided that, he's a man of great determination. So the history was of eagerness to push sales. I was opposed to that for policy reasons. As I indicated, the fact that I weakened incentives did not necessarily curb the habit, but it certainly weakened the habit. And to the extent that the competition in arms sales continued more covertly than it previously did.
Is it possible that Nixon and Kissinger had balance of payments considerations in mind when they made the large decision in May 72?
I don't think so. I don't know whether this is a compliment to the two gentlemen or a criticism, but Kissinger never worried 20 seconds about that kind of low commercial motive. And while Nixon might have, I don't think it was a major one. It became a motive later on, after the Yom Kippur War and the explosion of oil prices and the immense surpluses that the Shah began to pull in. At that point, we were seriously worried about our balance of payments position and the notion of getting back the monies we were paying out for oil by weapon sales became, I think, more powerful, became an increased motive. There was also, in a sense, a motive for me when I made the decision that we were going to reclaim part of the research and development costs and charge the Shah and others full cost for these weapons over the protests of the service who wanted to maximize sales by avoiding full cost pricing, since they were. Such sales did not go to the service. They were an indirect beneficiary of such sales. And that my notion of full cost pricing was based in part upon the explosion of balance of payment surpluses by the oil producers of the Middle East. So it was not a consideration that was irrelevant as far as I was concerned.
Did you enforce this policy?
What?
You enforced this policy?
While I was there, indeed, we loaded in research and development costs and full average cost pricing. What happened to it after I left, I don't know.
I have some questions about the price explosion in oil and OPEC prices. This happened in the fall, late fall of 73, early winter.
That's right.
Did you take part in the next administration's discussions of policy responses to this action? I just talked about a minute ago about the
policy. I was only marginally involved in that.
Moving on, Bill, in early 75.
In policy, insofar as it was defense responses in the event of during the period of the oil shortage or subsequently prospective oil shortages, what defense policies should be and how oil should be allocated, of course, and those things. I was fully engaged. But beyond that area, no.
On early 75, in the midst of the recession, Henry Kissinger suggested the possibility of military action against the oil producers as they kept on raising prices and economically strangled the West, as he put it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did Kissinger discuss this with you before he led up his statement?
You mean those particular words? No, he didn't discuss it with me, as I recall it, those particular words, but I was not unsympathetic to the point of view that he expressed. I thought that he expressed it rather boldly, and of course there the issue came up immediately. He talked to me before a press conference that I gave in the wake of his, I think it was Business Week article, and he said, yeah, I want you to climb in behind me and support what I said, which I certainly was prepared to do. The questions came up about what the Department of Defense could do to deal with the stranglehold, and we indicated that while we were not planning to do anything, that we certainly had the capability, so on. There was, I think, some consideration given to contingency plans for the movement into the Gulf if need arose, and indeed one could not respond to those kinds of things without taking out the contingency plans and looking at them. When I gave my press conference subsequently, I made certain statements about the United States being, while not wishing to act, if the President called upon us to act, that the Department was prepared to act and so forth, which was widely interpreted in the Persian Gulf as a threat. And so much of the criticism that had been directed towards Kissinger got deflected towards me, an outcome that he may have welcomed.
But beyond the top, the contingency planning, was there a serious discussion of this as an option internally, the NSC level or otherwise?
There was some discussion of it, yes. The fact of the matter was that it was widely viewed, it was a very revolutionary development, as it were, in that it was upsetting the established routine. The failure of the United States to crack the whip meant that the whip hand on such matters was passing away from the United States, and there was some discussion of the possibility of a seizure of one of the countries in the Gulf, one of the lesser countries, but there was, by and large, idle talk. No one was really serious about that, but I think it was more of an expression of frustration.
Now, after the oil price increases, there's an explosion or expansion of Iranian arms purchases.
Right.
They
could afford it.
That's right. There's a qualitative increase.
They could afford to pay full-cost pricing, as I indicated a moment ago, and would.
Now, in the light of the concern that you already had about arms sales to Iran and the implications for social and economic development, did this increasingly concern you? Did this concern you even more about the impact of
Iran? Yes. Not increasingly. It represented a continuation, perhaps of some degree of reinforcement of what had been a nagging worry. But I had the Shah, I hope, convinced that he needed to keep in mind the balance between civilian and military side and the balance within military expenditures so that his armed forces could fight. It was a continuing problem because of the weaknesses in country. I became increasingly concerned about something else, however, something that later became more obviously important later on, and that was the way that the Iranians and the American supplies were dealing with the lack of technical capability in country was to move more and more Americans into the country, contractor representatives and the like, who could service this equipment. My concern about that was quite simple, that the more Americans that you had in country living quite well, and as it were taking care of the military establishment to the extent that you did not have elements of the public sharing in the improvements in living conditions, those Americans would become the object of resentment. I wanted very much to hold down the number of Americans and tech reps and that sort of thing in the country. And therefore, the fact that the Shah could afford more was not necessarily a good thing from the standpoint of increase in hostility in the United States. I should emphasize, however, even though we were aware of, or I was aware of that general problem, none of us, I think, were aware of the degree to which hostility to the Americans would rise. None of us would have anticipated at that time the developments of 78, 79. But the general proposition that the more Americans you have living in the country, living high on the hog, the greater potential for anger was understood by me, and I hope by others. Now, there's one other aspect that I should mention, and that is that the explosion of resources that the Shah had meant that he could afford to increase living standards within the country, not necessarily by providing complex equipments, but by food supplies, the basic necessities of life. He should have done that. Indeed, one of the differences between the great success that the Saudis have had in precluding popular passions as where oil revenues rose and the Shah was that the Saudis were very attentive to the Bedouin, to the man in the street, and said that the benefits of that increased flow of revenue to the kingdom resulted in improved standard of living. The Shah, even though in his early years he had been a social reformer, as in the White Revolution, became quite indifferent to that and allowed so much of the revenue to be diverted away from the masses that there was this growing resentment. In retrospect, it's plain that what could have been helpful to the Shah became a liability in terms of controlling the country.
Did you get a sense of what accounted for that greater indifference to
this was an autocrat. Increasingly, with the passage of years, he knew best what was good for his country, and he cut off commentary from below. He had another problem. He was too bright. He was probably one of the best minds in the world, as I say, unchecked by contact and failing with other minds capable of. So he tended to build these castles in the sky, and nobody could break in to tell him there's a kind of great deal of restlessness out there. And, of course, the, to the extent that restlessness came up, it could always be presented to him as the work of agitators, Soviet-influenced people, and that sort of thing, some of which was true, but there was a lot there to feed on.
You mentioned a minute ago about your concern about the growing number of American technicians in Iran. Did you have the capacity to control the inputs, or was that something beyond your control, basically?
I could not control it. I could influence it to some extent and hope to influence it to more extent. But that was driven by the Shah, and while I could have in principle laid the wood to the contractors, I don't think that the expenditure of political capital would have worked it, even if the outcome were better. But with the shortage of trained people in the country, it was not obvious to me that denying American personnel in Iran would be beneficial on balance, because it would mean that these weapon systems wouldn't work and even more of the available Iranians would be
care and maintenance. I'm glad that members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff became concerned after 73 the expansion of arms sales to Iran would have a negative impact on the readiness of the U.S. military. Is this a concern that came to your attention? Or is this mentioned in the Senate report also?
No, I think that's one of those things that people think of in retrospect. What was true is that there was
a 76 other thing that's in the midst of it.
Yeah. I understand.
Yeah.
What was true was that after 73, that the rapid drawdown of U.S. inventories for the benefit of the Israelis created a good deal of problems within the military establishment. But the purchases by Iran were much more measured, so that while there's always concern it was very modest. And you must bear in mind that the services themselves were making up the delivery schedules, and the services, as we referred to a few moments ago, were very active in promoting sales to the extent that one stated later on that these dreadful sales might interfere with the delivery of equipments to our own units. That tends to be just a trifle hypocritical. I did not notice the Air Force, for example, saying a serious impact on the availability of F-15s leads us to conclude that it's best that the Navy deliver F-14s to Iran, or the Navy saying it's too much for us, let the Air Force handle this one. No, that's the kind of, there's a smidgen of truth in that, but only a smidgen, and it certainly didn't bother the military establishment by and large.
Now, through the arms sales for Iran, there were a number of instances where we reported that U.S. weapons sales had paid off Iranian officials to expedite the cement deals. Did we talk about this come to your attention very early in the game?
Yeah, so I think I talked to the Shah about that. And I got the standard answer from that there was no corruption inside of the country, which he himself just might have believed. It was against our policies. It was against the policies of the Department of Defense. We leaned against that as much as we could possibly do it in the abstract. And in the concrete, if we caught somebody, we would have punished them. But once again, you're, in retrospect at least, I think you're attempting to control something that can't be controlled, sort of like you're controlling the drug trade by talking to Colombian officials. When you have that demand, as you have in the United States, the supply will be forthcoming. When you have the demand in Iran, it's very hard to control by actions taken by this government.
Nelson argued that Kissinger, the State Department, passively discouraged or suppressed criticisms of the arms sales problems out of fear that might lead to that it might jeopardize congressional support for the program itself.
I think that's
exaggerated, or
I think that's perfectly true. I don't see anything exceptional about that. The United States government had a policy of supporting the Shah. Kissinger was thoroughly committed not only to the policy but to the rationale for the policy. They certainly don't like to see a lot of criticism that might affect or undermine the policy. I don't see anything exceptional about that. I think that within the administration that there was some tendency for the senior people at state to be blind to real problems, problems of balance, basically, because they were so committed to the policy. I think that that's a more serious matter, though perhaps not a more novel matter, than that they didn't want a lot of criticism that would interfere with congressional support. I've never noticed any administration that was eager to have criticism that spilled over into a loss of congressional support for the policies that the administration had embraced. And let's just take that as a given.
I know that in late 73, you met with the Shah, I guess in Iran, to discuss some of the implications of high-tech U.S. weapons.
I didn't go to Iran. I think that I can't remember. My recollection is of two trips that the Shah made to the United States, one in 73 and the other maybe in the spring of 75. In the spring of 75, I wound up being his official host for part of his trip and took him to his aircraft and so forth, because the president and Kissinger were out of town at the close of the trip, and I was the most senior visitor, the official president. But my recollection is that it was only on that two occasions that I visited with the Shah. I did not go to Iran.
In between those 2 years?
I did not go to Iran at all. Well, that brings you down to 1978, when I thought of going to Iran during the collapse, but no, I did not go to Iran. I have not been to Iran since the Ayatollah took over.
Okay.
I had many opportunities, needless to say. The Shah was quite eager to have American defense secretaries visiting his country.
Now, apparently during 73 or early 74, I'm not sure about the chronology, you appointed Richard Halleck.
Right.
As a representative in Iran.
I don't remember the precise details. As you know, Halleck had been at the Rand Corporation. I discovered that he was working for the Bureau of the Budget when I arrived at the Bureau of the Budget. Recollection serves me, I brought him over from the Bureau of the Budget to the Department of Defense sometime after I became Defense Secretary. Halleck had worked quite closely with the Turkish General Staff on these very problems that I've been describing to you. The problem of making sure that a force structure can fight, as well as merely having been equipped without the appropriate balance between sustaining capabilities, logistics, force structure, trained manpower, and so forth. One of the problems that you have with the underdeveloped countries, in fact, the developed countries, is that the hunger for hardware gets to be so compelling that they don't bother with all of the complementary capabilities that they need. And when I offered to provide to the Shah on that first trip, when I urged the Shah to have in mind a group that would study these things, I offered to provide some personnel. I don't remember whether the Shah accepted on the spot, as I indicated earlier. He sort of acquiesced in the general concept, and then either then or later indicated he would like to have some support. I sent Halleck out, presumably to do the same kind of mission that he had done for the Turkish general, in working with the Turkish general staff. And the basic purpose of that was to preclude the weapons sellers from inundating the country. That purpose became all the more pressing after the oil embargo, because there was so much cash sloshing around that the eagerness to acquire some of that cash became overwhelming.
Did you sort of monitor Halleck's efforts while he was there?
I monitored them in part. He would drop back every once in a while. I don't remember when we sent him out there. It must have been 74. When he came back, he would drop in and see me, but I think that I didn't have all the time to deal with one country. One that I, that was not central to my interests. My interests tended to center on NATO, which was my principal problem as far as I was concerned. These other countries, I regarded as a much less critical importance. I turned it over generally to Martin Hoffman, who was for some time the special assistant general counsel of the department and had been with me at the Atomic Energy Commission. So he followed that much more closely. Halleck did a great deal of complaining about the greedy and people from industry who were trying to acquire some of the Shah's wealth, the country's wealth, so that the later developments in his career, giving all of his preachments on the subject, simply astonished me when they came to light.
Which were?
They came to my attention when I...
What's that? Oh, was this glad he was in Iran?
It came to my attention when I was Secretary of Energy, it turned out. I don't remember the details precisely. You can find out from the Department of Defense, I presume, that he had signed a contract with the Shah and had gone on the Shah's payroll, which was quite explicitly prohibited. He had signed a contract with a firm that he had known. So, in view of all of his preachments on the subject, I found that stunning.
This is why he was working for you at DOD. He was in Iran.
No,
in Iran.
Well,
working for DOD.
He was. I don't remember the exact time. It was after. I think it was. He brought the subject up in the spring or summer of '75, and Hoffman and I simply told him that was totally unacceptable. So I assumed that it had gone away. Now, I don't know when he may have signed that contract. It didn't come to my attention again. It may be that he's signed the contract prior to my departure from the Pentagon or just after. But in any event, he was doing it knowing that that was in violation of department rules and explicit instructions, and indeed quite in conflict with what he had professed to be ethical behavior over the earlier years. before he came, I presume, in contact with the temptation of all that money.
It is a very important subject to discuss as he ended up promoting his former clients like Northrop, apparently.
Yep.
It was a very important subject to discuss with him in passing and says that he promoted, ended up promoting his former clients like Northrop.
Very interesting. Yeah. And I have, what is,
I don't know. It's a very important page with good intentions. Yeah. Talks about Halligan.
Yeah, it was for me a distressing thing because, first of all, I was the victim, ultimately the victim of deception by somebody whom I had known personally, and also just the corruption of the man. What I now take to be the corruption of the man. Since this stuff came up, I have very carefully avoided any further investigation into the matter. But
run out of tape somewhere.
I'm sure that in his own mind he's justified it all. By that time, of course, I had a long involvement with Kissinger, and I had pointed out that we needed to have a more orderly process in country, and that what we ought to have was a defense representative in country. Who would be able to, what shall I say, bring the various service mags closer together, and that the Secretary of Defense representative at NATO was a useful adjunct, and I suggested we have that. Well, it took about 6 or 9 months to persuade Henry that that was appropriate. First of all, he normally resisted this kind of thing simply for bargaining purposes. And secondly, he was not eager, I think, to have any dilution of State Department dominance, a point of view that I can understand, but the fact of the matter was that we needed more on-the-spot representative of what I'll call the highest policy position, highest policy perspective. And he, I don't remember when von Marbod went out there. It was
September 75.
It was after the fall of, he was our man in Vietnam for extricating equipment from Vietnam. It was after the fall of Vietnam in April of 75 that he became, in a sense, available. We had some months of argument. He went out there, you say, in the beginning of the fall. And his relationship with Halleck was very good, and then they got to squabbling with one another, and I don't know the details about it. I have not, happily, since it all occurred after I left the Pentagon, I didn't have to listen to a great deal of commentary on it.
I suppose it's about the events that led up to that decision to send von Marbod. Now, between 73, you met with Shah, and 75, when you met with him again, were there any discussions with high-level Iranian officials about arms sales and their locations?
General Tufanian was in?
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many times. Yeah. It might have been 4 times, it might have been 8 times, but he... I remember that he was, in a sense, a regular visitor. That is, not every other month, mind you, but he came in with some regularity when he came to the United States and would see Tufanian. But I did not I would reinforce, if I recall correctly, the points that I had made to the Shah, but I did not get into any detailed discussion, first of all, to Tufanian. I mean, that decisions in that country were not made by General Tufanian. In general, they weren't made by anybody but the Shah himself.
I read that Assistant Secretary of Defense for ISA, Robert Ellsworth, became concerned about the issue of arms sales for Iran during the 74-75. Apparently in March 75.
That's correct. It is correct that Ellsworth was concerned. I don't recall any dates in particular. Ellsworth talked to me. He was driven by one of the senior civil servants in the ISA, Glenn Blixted or some such name. I can't remember the name, but indeed Ellsworth was concerned. I don't see any reason why he shouldn't be, but I shared the concerns, as I've indicated.
I was going to ask you about the study that you mentioned. Let's look at the study and the question currently.
That's right. I don't remember the details, but they, in general, the study raised the right questions. But was addressed to the right questions.
I read one thing that apparently the study by the International Security Affairs Office recommended that an office in ISA be set up to deal exclusively with Iranian affairs issues involving arms sales. Was that the case, or do you recall if that's the case?
I don't recall. I wouldn't be surprised. That tended to be the general solution.
Sounds like a new office. A result of these decisions was probably the decision to send von Marburg as a representative, I guess.
There were a number of things mixed in together, kind of a Alex reports that there should be an official representative of the Secretary of the Defense there rather than an unofficial one who was as an advisor. And Halleck had been given instructions that he was there as an advisor, that he was not to give instructions, and he did not abide by that. But he was in an advisory capacity rather. Policy capacity, and that one really needed to have somebody else out there. The services, quite naturally, were quite suspicious of Halleck in his role. By having a former Secretary of Defense representative out there, one could avoid some of those difficulties.
What were von Marburg's general instructions?
The general instructions basically were what I've already indicated to you, that we are not engaged in attempting to fatten up a balance of payments. These people are supposed to pay full costs, however, in view of their earnings. The services are supposed to be there to provide real assistance to the host country rather than simply to facilitate sales, and that the services aren't to be engaged in dogfights. Go out there and support the. There was, of course, some concern, I think, on Dick Helms' part. He got to like von Marburg after a while, I believe, although you'd have to talk to him. But initially, he thought that this might, in some way, just detract from the role of the embassy and the ambassador. Point on which I think I reassured him when he visited me in the spring of 75. He either embraced or acquiesced in the arrangement, and later on thought that it was very helpful to him. But of course, you ought to talk to Helms on that rather than to
me. This might be an obscure point, but apparently after von Marburg arrived, the chief of Army Mag, General Vandenberg, was quickly relieved of his post in Carolina. Did you recall hearing about that?
I recall that, and I forget just what the problem was. But my recollection it was that it was a personal problem.
It wasn't a policy issue.
It may have had a policy element. My recollection is that it was a personal problem.
second part of the interview with James Schlesinger by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on June 27, 1986. The interview is part of a joint effort by the Columbia University Oral History Office and the Foundation for Iranian Studies.
Now, Dr. Schlesinger, in the last interview, you mentioned that there was a special relationship between Richard Nixon and the Shah that had some impact on U.S. policy towards Iran. Now, how do you explain that relationship?
Well, I thought I'd mention that. It seems to me that...
that was after the interview you mentioned it.
It seems to me that while Nixon was... out of office after he'd been defeated in 1960, and possibly after he was defeated for governor of California in 62, he did some traveling around the world, and one must recognize that for a defeated politician, courtesies are most welcome. In the case of the Shah, he gave Nixon considerable hospitality, as opposed, let's say, to some of the nations in Europe. And as a consequence, Nixon was steadily grateful to the Shah and felt a personal bond.
Uh-huh. Okay, I can explain that. I have one question about the arms sale issue, which I forgot to mention last time. During your tenure as Secretary of Defense, were you subject personally to pressures from firms that were trying to sell weapons to Iran? In other words, did executives from firms try to convince you or persuade you to extradite certain sales or accept certain sales?
No, because I had very little to do with the defense industry. I tried generally to avoid seeing them, and I only saw them when I had something that I wanted them to do with regard to weapon system, for example, the F-16, F-100 engine combination. After we made that choice, I saw the senior executives, but I did not expose myself. I didn't have the time to waste to listen to their blandishments regarding their wares. The only pressure I got was from the Congress, and most notably from Senator Symington, who was on the Armed Services Committee, and was indignant that I had not pushed the F-15 on the Shah. As I indicated, I did not think I would have taken the F-15 if I had been the Shah, if he had asked me my own judgment about that, but I did not think that the complex logistical trains that were required by both the F-15 and the F-14 were worth it, and therefore I urged the Shah to avoid taking on two new sophisticated aircraft.
So in terms of pressure, do you want people in the services that would feel those pressures are middle-level people in the Defense Department? To deal more with the officials from
the pressures might be felt right up to the top of the services, and indeed, in many cases, will be felt by the civilian secretaries of the service departments. I made it a rule that we were not going to use arms sales as a way of balancing the balance of trade, and that. Arms sales should not be for commercial reasons, but instead should be for very carefully analyzed strategic reasons. So the services were not so constrained by other secretaries of defense, and they sometimes pressed sales purely for commercial reasons.
Now, sometime in the mid-70s, I'm not quite sure about the date, some high-level U.S. military officials made with the Shah put as a U.S. commitment to use a proposed naval base at Chabahar, Apparently this conversation caused a soft left in the State Department, because it was U.S. declaratory policy to have limited naval deployment in the Indian Ocean, with the exception being Diego Garcia, apparently. Do you recall this incident or these discussions?
I recall it vaguely.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, Henry Kissinger, when he was Secretary of State, never chided the Department of Defense for its vigor in expanding our capabilities, and particularly in the Indian Ocean. I'm sure that there may have been reservations elsewhere in the Department of State, but it was not Kissinger's policy to try to seek the demilitarization of the Indian Ocean or anything like it. Some of the people who worked on the regional desks may have felt that to be desirable and may have felt under pressure from the states in the region that tended to support it. After the 1973 war in the Middle East, it was clearly the joint desire of both Kissinger and myself to expand our base structure in the Indian Ocean. That was the reason for Diego Garcia. Most of my recollections go along those lines. There, with regard to the specific question that you raised, I do recall, though vaguely, that the Navy chose some to exhibit some initiative of its own that was not well coordinated with government policy as a whole. And to the extent there was objection to the Navy's initiative, it was more in terms of its failure to coordinate with the government as a whole than any disinclination on the part of the government at the highest level to acquire additional base rights. We were quite concerned in that period, and particularly after 1973, we were quite concerned about our basing capacity versus the Soviets.
Because I remember one of the documents, one of the capture documents that were taken from the embassy, discusses this issue. It suggests that there was some concern about having overt stance towards expanding naval capacity.
Sir?
The document suggests that there was some concern about having an overt stance of expanding naval capacities. I guess it's a statement. Now, what do you think the significance of those discussions might have been between the Navy and the Shah regarding the Shah of our base? Yeah. That's the part we missed a minute ago. What do you thought? Explain what the nature of the Shah's understanding of commitments might have been.
Well, the Shah understood full well that any discussion between military officials and the Shah had only limited relevance, that the decisions were dominated by the civilian authorities in the United States. The Shah, based upon his own experience with his own military subordinates, knew full well that the military subordinates could not commit Iran, and he would assume the same thing was true of the United States. I have no doubt that there were exploratory conversations on the part of naval officers with their Iranian counterparts regarding the availability of bases in the Indian Ocean during periods of emergency. Indeed, I vaguely recall those conversations. But that is quite different from a commitment, as is implied here, a commitment by the United States to use certain facilities. Commitment's the wrong word. If they were seeking an option on those facilities, that would have been quite appropriate. And I do indeed, I expect that indeed was the case. There were people in the Department of State who had the feeling that the United States should limit its presence in the Indian Ocean, that should emphasize the demilitarization of the Indian Ocean. But that was never the attitude of the Secretary of State. Kissinger, and particularly after the 73 war, strongly supported efforts to establish an appropriate base structure in the Indian Ocean. Diego Garcia was perhaps the most notable example, but it was not well placed with regard to an Indian, with regard to a Persian Gulf conflict. Therefore, we saw it based elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, in May 75, the Shah visited Washington with President Ford and Secretary Kissinger and so forth. Did this visit have any special significance that you can recall?
Well, the significance of the visits, I think, was primarily in terms of getting to know the new American president. I suspect, I do not know if I knew at the time, I've forgotten, that the notion of the visit originated with the Shah. That he had a close and intimate relationship with Richard Nixon, that he barely knew President Ford, that it was important for him to come visit the United States in order to have a personal relationship with Ford, and to get, I presume he would want to do, a reiteration of the closeness of the American-Iranian relationship and the backing by the United States for the role of the Shah.
Were there any specific issues discussed within that general context, arms sales issues or otherwise?
I believe that they were. You'll have to remind me of what they were specifically. The as you know, the Shah was something of a philosopher of geostrategy, and he spelled out once again, and in more glowing terms, his concerns about what was happening to the northeast of Iran, the dismemberment, the prospective dismemberment of Pakistan, what he feared was growing Soviet domination, as he saw it then, of Afghanistan and the like. And he was very much imbued with his own role as the protector of the region. As we know, during that period, his self-confidence continued to grow, sense of self-importance continued to grow. He had this view of his role in stabilizing the region, although he felt the vulnerabilities of his own country because of Soviet penetrations in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Now, in the course of it, he, of course, was discussed the new equipments that he wanted to have to buttress his position.
Yeah, according to the New York Times article I saw, he wanted to buy four or five Boeing 707s with airborne warning and control systems, as well as A-10 attack bombers and F-14 fighters, a number of each of them.
I'm sorry?
Did he discuss these purchases with you?
What was the list?
The Boeing 707s,
the AWACS. That was on the list. Uh-huh. What were the others?
A-10 attack bombers,
uh-huh,
as well as F-14 fighters.
Well, of course,
that was already an issue.
The question was of additional F-14s, mm-hmm, and the answer was that there was no problem about that. The A-10s I have less recollection of, but the A-10 was, of course, designed as a close air support aircraft, and if the Shah wanted to buy them, that was fine with us. Indeed, it seemed to us to be more relevant for his purposes than some of the fancier equipment that he normally wanted to buy. The A-10 was not a state-of-the-art aircraft. And finally, the AWACS issue, would have caused, as we can see in retrospect, did cause much greater concern, but the decision of the earlier period indeed continued to prevail. If the Shah wanted to buy four or five Iraqis, he was going to have them.
Did you make any effort? Did you agree with that, or did you adopt a reservation for someone?
Once again, I have very thin memory after all these years, but my recollection is indeed that I made some vague passes of discouraging him, making sure that he understood that these were very expensive equipment. But having done that in a perfunctory way, I think I subsided, but my recollection may be quite wrong on that. Well, it's not quite wrong on that, but my recollection may be a little bit off on that.
The sales all went through, basically.
Mm-hmm. They were going through, and as you know, they reached the peak in the Carter period, and as I recall it, Admiral Turner protested vigorously about the sale of AWACS to the Shah, but it was in the Carter period that these issues came to culmination in the form of contracts. At that time, there were only kind of verbal promises that if indeed you want the AWACS, you can have it.
What was the overall tone of these discussions? Was it fairly friendly? Was there any?
Very friendly.
Okay. Were there any rumors at this time about the Shah's health? The New York Times suggested that there were concerns that he looked weak or not as healthy as he had in earlier years.
Let me say, with regard to the prior question, that I think I mentioned that I was the Shah's host in that period. Because the President Kissinger, for some reason or other, had to go out of town, so I escorted him during his last day here. To his chopper and the like. Now, I do not know whether the Shah might have felt that the new president and the Secretary of State were not giving him his due deference under those conditions. I can only speculate on that since he certainly did not raise the subject with me. But, in regard to friendliness, he may have inferred that reflected a somewhat scaled down degree of intimacy with the United States as compared with the Nixon period. What was the next question?
Was there any concern for this period about the Shah's health at all?
No. The Shah at that time looked quite vigorous on the occasion of that visit. I think that in 1978, none of us knew of the nature of the Shah's ailment, even though he had been treated by French doctors. Some wondering why we didn't know that he had been treated by French doctors. In 1978, Blumenthal, for example, who had known the Shah for many years, visited there, and I think it was late October, early November of 78, and he was shaken by the Shah's appearance. But I think that he attributed it more to the political conditions and the shock that these political conditions have had on the Shah's well-being than to any serious health conditions. So in 75, there was no...
The only reason I mentioned there was an article in the Times I saw in that year suggesting that Shaw looked drawn and worn compared to earlier periods. So that was interesting to see that. Okay. Now, apparently, I read sometime in the summer of 75, General Tufani, there was a report that he had plans to develop tank production capacities in Iran, tank building factories. Did they ever discuss these plans with you, that they wanted to...
I don't recall. As I mentioned last time, the administration was inclined to back activities in terms of co-production. I do not positively recall that, but we would have had no objection to that. As you know, there was talk of Bell Helicopter about co-production. There was talk about co-production of the TOW missile. I would have been much more concerned about that because of the greater sophistication of the technology. And I resisted the TOW missile co-production, though unsuccessfully. If the Shah had wanted to produce tanks, we would not have thought it. So I have no recollection of that.
Yeah.
That was the kind of thing that we preferred to sell directly for balance of payments, for example.
Right. Now, last time you mentioned the study that Glenn Plotkin did of Iran and arms sales, basically. And I read in Gary Fick's book that you took that report and used it as a basis for a letter to President Ford requesting an NSC review of arms sales to the Shah and Persian Gulf countries generally, apparently.
Well, I don't recall precisely what I did at that time. I certainly was sufficiently concerned about the evolution of U.S.-Iranian relations that I made representations to the White House during 1975. To what extent that reflected the views of Dick Halligan, the concern that we had about getting a special defense representative in country, to what extent it represented the report by itself. All of these things were reflected in a broad concern within the department that we put relations with Iran on a systematic basis rather than simply following what I'll call the visceral impulses of the Shah.
Now, Sick also suggests that Henry Kissinger stalled on any effort to get a response to this request for an NSC study. Does that ring a bell?
That certainly rings a bell, because there was an extended period of no response. It was not the sort of thing that Kissinger welcomed in general, and more particularly, even for those things about which he felt neutral, he normally delayed consideration as a way of building up bargaining position and political capital for a future negotiation. So I do recall that Henry was not immediately responsive, but that was par for the course.
So Sig suggested this is part of an overall struggle for power and influence between you and Kissinger. This Iran issue was just one facet of that. Is that possible?
Well, I think that over-dramatized it. I think that we had different views on a number of subjects. In the case of... I tended to react to particular issues at the time of the fall of the Greek colonels or in relation to what was going on in Iran. And it was specific issues that worried me. Kissinger may, intended to do things in this manner, he may have regarded this as part of a broad-based struggle for power. Certainly not my view. To the extent that there was a competition for influence, I tended to be primarily concerned about maintaining control within the Department of Defense and to influence the arms control talks with the Soviet Union, which impacted directly on the central mission of the Department of Defense. In these other areas, they were really much more episodic, and to treat it as part of a struggle for power is to make it far more grand than is actually the case. There may have been much more of a struggle for power, competition for influence, I would prefer to say, in the issue of U.S.-Soviet relations as it impacted on arms control. But that would be the end of it. That was the central concern that I had in this.
Now, what project that emerged in the mid-70s was the IBEX project, which was to increase the capacity to monitor Soviet military activities from stations in Iran. Now, I've read that, that there was some controversy over this project. Do you recall the nature of the debate?
That was the CIA project?
I think it was basically a CIA project. I'm not really sure.
Indeed, there is controversy, but I don't want to discuss it.
Was it more technical controversy or technical issues related to it, or more
political
issue?
It was basically cost effectiveness issues. I do not. And questions of U.S. arms people and the appropriateness of the equipment that they might be selling and so forth. There may have been some bureaucratic conflict too, though I don't recall the nature.
Okay.
But the central questions, as I recall, are the cost-effectiveness issues, and there were disagreements management issues.
I bet it was finally abandoned. Was that under Ford or later on, this whole project?
You'll have to ask somebody at the agency.
Yeah. Okay. Now, during the mid-70s, the Shah's human rights policy also became a matter of public debate. Now, within the Nixon and Ford administrations, was there much concern expressed internally in private discussions about the Shah's policies towards the domestic opponents?
Not very much. That was unfashionable. It was certainly have elicited a contemptuous guffaw during the Nixon years. Ford would have been more inclined to be more sensitive to the domestic political repercussions. To the extent that you have domestic displays or stories that might have been more sensitive to that, he would not have been inclined to scoff at the issue as would have been Nixon's hands. But he certainly did not pick it up, so far as I know.
Now, in the meetings with the Shah, did he discuss these charges with officials? Did he complain about members of Congress making accusations and so forth?
I think only indirectly.
Yeah.
It was not a central concern. Ford was very much guided in these matters by Kissinger. He did not regard himself as an authority on foreign policy issues. Kissinger certainly retained the most favorable attitude towards the Shah. Consequently, the Shah would not be harassed by anyone within the administration. There was no Bureau of Human Rights or whatever the devil is called in the State Department. And expressions on Capitol Hill tended to come from liberal Democrats, those who regarded as leftist Democrats, and they were simply brushed off. And I do not recall any specific conversations, but I'm sure if the subject came up, that he would have had the reaction of, oh, that's X, and he's always off on some leftist line, don't pay any attention to him.
Okay. Now, we'll move on to the Carter period. I think in January 77, President Carter appointed you a special assistant for Energy Affairs, and later he became Department of Energy Secretary. Now, during this period,
as assistant to the president, with primary responsibility in Energy Affairs, but dealt with other issues if they have to interest the president.
During this early period of 77, 78, were you involved in any issues concerning Iran or OPEC, the Shah and OPEC?
Yes, indeed. Although our relations with the Shah over OPEC matters were rather touchy, because the Shah tended to be and been the hawk on pricing, and he preferred to work with the Saudis, because the Saudis had tended to resist the more aggressive moves with regard to OPEC pricing. The Saudis tended, we encouraged the Saudis to resist the request for higher prices, and the Saudis tended to do so. OPEC issues tended to be back burner issue during that period. The price of oil remained stabilized at about roughly $13 a barrel. The problems with OPEC began to arise as the Shah was falling, and under those circumstances they were both secondary, and they were hardly things that one would discuss with the Shah, so the brief answer is no, we didn't talk about OPEC matters. What was the other thing?
What is it?
Well, we didn't discuss extensively how he always referred to the price of oil.
I read that when Shah visited Washington in the fall of 77, that he made some sort of agreement to try to get OPEC to hold the line on any further price increases. I guess, you know, President Carter asked him to go along with this. Do you recall?
Yeah, I recall that, but it was not the central line of our efforts, obviously, yeah. When you run into a major oil producer during the conversations. Mr. Carter was inclined to do touch all bases, and he would say, I hope you'll hold the line on prices. As I've indicated, it was not a serious problem in 1977. By 78, it became a serious problem, but that was because the Shah himself was falling, and it was not the central issue of our relationship to him, and he had little control over the problem. The proximate cause of the rise in oil prices in late 78 and 79 was the strike of the oil field workers in Iran against the Shah, which he would dearly have liked to have been able to settle, but was not in a position to do so. What was the other issue that you raised?
I think there wasn't one, but I was going to ask how you would characterize President Carter's general approach to the Shah and Iran during the year and a half or so before the revolution erupted.
Ambivalent. The curious thing about it was that he had an ambivalence towards the Shah that continued throughout Shah's period. Throughout the Shah's tenure, but the public expression of that ambivalence grew less and less as the Shah got into greater trouble. And he began to talk glowingly of the Shah, and as I recall, it visited Iran in the beginning of 1978 and said some glowing things about the Shah. That shouldn't have been taken too seriously, because Carter tended to say glowing things about whomever he was visiting while he was visiting us. But Carter had deep, deep concerns about the human rights issue, in contrast to Nixon, who would have stopped with them, and Ford, who paid little attention to them and would be encouraged not to pay any attention to them by Kissinger. Kissinger was not known to be a crusader on human rights.
But did you get the sense that Carter was actually putting pressure on the Shah to liberalize? Or was it more indirect and subtle? Or
I don't know the answer to that because I was not privy to the most intimate conversations between him and the Shah. It is not beyond Jimmy Carter to press his case directly. But the Shah clearly heard that of central concern to the new president of the United States was the issue of human rights. Because that was something that Carter tended to talk about almost every time he spoke publicly. And that in his quest to accommodate the incoming president of the United States, with whom he hoped to get along, that the Shah would take into account that this was a central concern in general, would apply it to his own country, and thus attempted to ameliorate human rights conditions as a way of propitiating Carter, even if Carter never asked him to do it directly. I do not know whether he did or he didn't. I suspect, given Carter's nature, that he could not refrain from at least a hint in that direction in his private conversations, but that he would have regarded as inappropriate to indulge in a harangue on the issue.
In terms of, say, fundamental policy, the basics of policy, in terms of the basics of policy, fundamental policy, was there any really major shift away from the policy support that Kissinger had articulated, the basic policy supporting the Shah's tenure in Iran?
I don't think that there was a basic shift away, if you mean a change in policy.
Yeah.
However, the Shah was viewed with much greater skepticism than he had been previously, and he knew it. And that even though there was not any declaration of a shift, the policy had indeed shifted, because instead of all-out backing as our chosen instrument in the area, you would have an attitude of, this is our ally, he is important in the region, but he himself has serious political flaws to answer for. That would be the attitude of the Carter people. And it follows from Carter's long-term, consistent, deeply felt stress on human rights. The surprising thing was that he kept that under control as much as he did during the last days of the Shah.
Now, as you know, the revolution broke out in the fall of 78, and on November 6th, the Shah declared a martial law government in Iran.
Now, I remember that very
well. What was your initial reaction to this emerging situation?
My initial reaction to the emerging situation was primary concern about pushing the energy legislation through the Congress, which preoccupied me until the fall of 1978.
This is the bill to create the Department of Energy?
No, that had passed
okay.
Early in 1977. This was the National Energy Act, which consisted of five legislative parts during much of the spring and summer of 1978. I had spent endless hours up there on the hill trying to move the Natural Gas Act as a component of the National Energy Act, trying to move each house and so forth. So my time was more or less devoted to those activities. I had little enough time to devote to it. I did receive a letter from one of my former subordinates in the DOD, Fritz Kramer, in March or April, which said, in his cryptic style, "Sir, colon, the Shah is in mortal peril. Yours sincerely, F.G.A. Kramer." I often cited that later on as indicating that the developments in Iran was not so obscure as some in the U.S. intelligence community might have wanted to pretend. But towards the end of summer, beginning with the developments with the fire in Abadan in September, somewhere then I began to devote an increasing part of my time to the developments in Iran. As the legislation finally passed, just before my trip to China, which started in October, about October the 15th, I was devoting some substantial time, and I had the entire resources of the international arm of the Department of Energy to work with, and the Assistant Secretary for International Affairs, Harry Bergold, was devoting most of his energies to monitoring developments in Iran for me. I mention this because in his book, Gary Six suggests that the Department of Energy did not have the staff or manpower to handle these kinds of things. It had a hell of a lot more manpower than did the NSC staff. Not as intimately related, but manpower or staff problems were a source of difficulty for us.
There were people in Tehran that could report to you what was going on? Energy Department people?
No, I was following the intelligence.
Okay. And
Bergold was picking up the gossip on a daily basis. Now, we left around October the 20th, I would guess, for China. During the trip to China, of course, there were only occasional opportunities to look at the press and to note that the difficulties in Tehran were increasing. The difficulties throughout Iran were increasing. I believe that by then that the oil fields were pretty well shut down, and there was deep concern. When the Shah declared martial law, it was on a day that we were flying north, I believe, into what the Chinese now call the northeast, what we referred to as Manchuria. And we devoted the day, several hours during that day, to considering the implications of that development. I had the desire, and I expressed it at the time, to take the government aircraft which we were using and just fly directly to Tehran, because I was the only official in the U.S. government that traced back to the Nixon years and had the one who had the longest personal association with the Shah, just to buck up the Shah under those circumstances. I did not follow that inclination because I could not. In a sense, I had the President Carter had agreed to delay the official signing of the National Energy Acts, all five of them, until I returned for the signing ceremony. That took place, if I recall the date, on November the 9th, 1978, and I had to be back here for that signing ceremony, and obviously could not, under those circumstances, go to Tehran. But I was strongly tempted to do so, because I felt, without having seen the Shah, that he needed bucking up under the circumstances, that the Shah tended to be quite timid, that he would need to be encouraged by the Americans, that once having declared martial law, that he should back real martial law. He did not do so. He put in place a general who was not decisive, who indeed promptly had a heart attack, and throughout the period that official period of martial law, it was plain that the Shah didn't have his heart in it, and that as a result, the martial law kind of backfired. When I returned to the United States, from the day I landed here, my principal concern was attempting to preserve the Shah's regime, in the course of which I visited with all of the principal advisors, political advisors to the president. I had extensive conversations with Kaczynski. I attended many of the National Security Council meetings on the subject. Yeah, Kaczynski brought me in more or less as a supporter. I talked to all of Carter's principals. I talked to Jordan Powell. I talked to the lawyer from Atlanta who was in Stray
Edwards. Who? Kerbo?
Yeah, Charlie Kerbo.
Yeah.
I talked to Charlie Kerbo. Charlie Kerbo, to say the least, had less of a geopolitical sense than any man that I've encountered. And all that he was concerned about was whether they were going to throw and have to be gasoline rations, as you put it. And I tried to convince all of them, and was successful with Jordan Powell, that the president had to realize that what the political stakes were for him. I recognized by that time that one could not.
Roll this over the tape. You're talking about the political stakes involved in the revolution for President Carter.
Well, I recognized by that time that one had to stress the political stakes involved, that there was little point in approaching the president on the basis of the realpolitik or the strategic interests of the United States or the geopolitical role of the Shah or anything of that sort, and that the way to affect the president was to deal with his domestic base by dealing with those advisors who were closest to him. So I talked to Jordan, I talked to Charlie Kerbo. I thought Kerbo could best be moved on the political issue. He could not be. First of all, nobody has less of a sense of international politics than Kerbo, but moreover, he was totally convinced that the position of the president was politically impregnable and that nothing could occur to damage it. That was his long-term view. Jordan was very sympathetic, and Jordan promised to go and speak to the president. He kept making that promise on and off. He was a great procrastinator until the middle of December, by which time it was getting very late in the game.
Did you personally ever approach President Carter with your plan for a special representative?
Well, yes, indeed, I did do that, and I can come to that later on. First, you better deal with the ball issue.
One plan that did come up by George Ball for a Council of Notables, which I think he recommended in mid-December 78. How did you assess that plan?
Well, I had seen a fair amount of coal. It was introduced towards the end of November, and so these discussions are mid-November. Brzezinski said that he had brought him in. Blumenthal said that he had brought him in. I don't know just what the origins were, but he was to do a study for the president. And at the time, I thought less of Paul's recommendations than I do today. In retrospect, I think that they were better than I thought at the time. I would say that Paul's views were quite different from mine and Brzezinski's. We thought that any visible attempts of the United States to undercut the Shah would be devastating, because it would cut the confidence of the military establishment in U.S. support and in the Shah, and that the military were the critical element in sustaining the regime. I think that is correct, and I've always thought that that was correct. Paul's views were quite different. He wanted to ease the Shah out in favor of a council of notables. I regarded that then, and regard it today, as rather academic, because the Western-oriented notables with whom we know had no political base in the country to speak of, and that we thought they had a political base because they associated with Americans and spoke pretty good English, but they were relics of the past, basically, and reflected the remnants of the National Front of Mossadegh and the like. There were some eminent people amongst them, but they did not have independent standing. In order to control the country, one needed the throne and the army. I don't think there was a full enough appreciation of that. In retrospect, I think less harshly of Paul's views, because we know now what we did not know then, that the Shah was mortally ill, and that the Shah knew that he was mortally ill, and that the Shah might have been persuaded indeed to move aside because of illness and establish a regency. Then you could have used the regency to attempt to broaden the base. But the essential standoff in the country was between the elements of authority represented by the military and the elements of insurrection represented by Khomeini. One had to look at these central features, in my judgment. If you had a regency in favor of the Crown Prince, you would certainly have wanted to attempt to broaden the base and to take advantage of that shift to bring in other elements that had been alienated by the Shah, the bazaars. I don't think there was much you could do about most of the clergy by that time. They were following Khomeini and had the bit between their teeth. But the notion that a council of notables would have sufficient legitimacy to control the country struck me as a weak notion. I am more, and still does, I am more persuaded today that in light of his illness, that it would have been a good idea to ease the Shah out and move towards a regency.
You assumed at the time that the military would, in fact, you assumed that the special representative was sent to the Shah to bark him up, as you said, that he could reinforce his will to impose a strength of the martial law.
I'm not sure that we got that on the tape, did we?
I think that you mentioned that earlier, the idea was bucking up the Shah.
Well, yeah, I wanted to buck up the Shah, and that I knew that he had felt keenly the ambivalence of the Carter administration, and that he would be wavering given the Shah's nature, and that what we had to do, if we were to salvage the throne, was to give an unequivocal demonstration of support. And that could come only from people that he knew were solid supporters. I think that it's clear that he did not regard Bill Sullivan in the embassy as a solid supporter. And I urge that, I urge Jordan that not only do we make clear what where our stand was, but we do so effectively by sending myself, Walker Jinsky, out there. The reason I felt that I myself would have been appropriate was that I traced back to the Nixon period and I had the longest personal relationship with the Shah. That's why I thought of flying there from Peking. But I urged Jordan and Powell to recognize the importance, as well as others. I had the same conversation with Brzezinski, but I didn't have to spend much time arguing with Brzezinski since he was there before I had gotten to him, but how important it was for us to continue to display fidelity to the throne. And that the best thing to do, I urged Brzezinski as well as Jordan, was to send myself out there or him out there, and Brzezinski carried that to the president. Jordan kept saying that he wanted to talk to the president about these matters in order to convey quietly the political consequences for the president, decision for being Jordan, he never got around to it because he was a man who devoted himself to one thing at a time. Part of the problem of the American government in that period was that it was so preoccupied with a number of things, including the breakthrough with China, which came more or less concurrently, the SALT negotiations and the like. Cy Vance was totally devoted to the SALT negotiations in that period. And Jordan himself was a sort of a one-issue man, so he just procrastinated towards the middle of December and told me he hadn't gotten around to it and suggested that I go see the president myself. It was very late in the game. I continued to work with Brzezinski on trying to shore up our overall position. So at the end of the month, I suggested that we send the Constellation, I believe, as a carrier without it. Philippines into the Indian Ocean. And a demonstration of U.S. support. That incidentally was less in terms of intimidating the Shah's opponents in Iran, which was difficult were possible to do. And in terms of bucking up the Saudis who were, and others in the region who saw our policy as wobbling, this would be a visible demonstration of U.S. power and concern. Brzezinski agreed to do that, and we attacked that at one of the little NSC committee meetings. We got Cy Vance to go along with that. Somewhat to my surprise, Harold Baum was on these issues mostly in the middle. The message was sent up to the president at the same time that Harold dispatched the Constellation towards the Straits of Malacca with the notion of staying outside of the Straits of Malacca. That worked out just disastrously. If I had ever had any notion that the Constellation would go down the Straits of Malacca and then be turned back, I would never have made the suggestion in the first place, because that kind of tended to confirm the image of a wobbling, waffling America that was under no circumstances prepared to use its power. It gave just the opposite demonstration of what we wanted. I wondered what had happened to it. At the time, I had suspected that Vance, during his trip to Camp David, had persuaded the president not to send it. I suspected that Vance was ambivalent, but according to the account of Gary Sick, that was not the problem. The problem was the leak, and that Carter had heard about it, and he was infuriated and turned it around for what I'll call issues of presidential pride that have nothing to do whatsoever with the geopolitical questions in the region.
Now, a minute ago, you mentioned that you had taken your proposal for a special representative to President Carter.
I did indeed. But I've got to say that by the end of the month, by the end of December, I was beginning to despair of the situation in the region. There was talk of the Shah's departure. I went to the president early in January, and we spent some considerable time together. Now, I've got to stress that my relations with Jimmy Carter always, almost invariably, were very good. They were warm. He tended to have a considerable affection for me. And we usually had a good deal of spirited discussion that passed beyond the usual dry conveying of facts. This was true of my experience in many areas. Most notably, but not confined to energy discussions. And the reason that I mentioned that was that on that occasion, early in January, when I visited with the president, that the relationship was very cold indeed. The encounter was a cold one. I talked to what I expressed my concern as to the consequences of the fall of the Shah and the critical importance of the army. And the president indicated these things are not going to be released until I want them released, are they?
Absolutely.
The president indicated, the president was taken up in one of his bouts of enthusiasm. About the fact that there was great hope. There was great hope because the Shah was now restoring the Constitution of 1906, and that the Majlis was going to be reassembled. He indicated that there would be a new premier and that would be Barzagan. And he stated there would be a new premier that was kind of in the press at the time, as well as in the tables. And that there was great hope as a result of the restoration of constitutionalism in the country. And this struck me, since I had been, as I say, devoting much of my time to this. Much more in the role of power in such affairs than in the role of, I'll say, constitutionalism, or the politics of generosity, or what have you. This struck me as utterly naive. I think I spoke more sharply to the president than was my wont or what that he expected. And I said, Mr. President, that's just American civics. The Constitution of 1906 has precious little to do with the outcome in the country. That the critical question is the fidelity of the army to the throne. That, in my judgment, if the Shah leaves the country and the throne is in danger, Mr. Barzagan is not going to last 6 weeks. Reacted angrily, though Jimmy Carter gets colder when he gets angry. His voice can convey disapproval of my message, if not of me. He said, yes, I understand that the role of the Army is critical, and that is why we're going to send out a representative of the President, as you have suggested, and that the representative of the President will be General Heiser. We will be going there sometime in the near future. Maybe the next few days. And I responded sharply again, as is my wont. I never learned the appropriate deference to presidents. I responded quite sharply that General Heiser is a man that I know and admire. He used to work with me, worked during the airlift to Israel. I know him quite well, but General Heiser is just the wrong man to send out there, Mr. President. First place, he is stationed in Europe. He has no connection with you. He is not a personal representative of the President of the United States. He is just a military man. And this will not be taken to be a clear and unequivocal demonstration of American support for the throne. Since he does not represent you, he represents the United States in some more limited sense. Moreover, I said, Dutch Heiser has very limited experience in Iran and relatively limited experience in these kinds of diplomatic matters. And moreover, he very clearly comes from the wrong service, Mr. President. The problem in Iran is that the outcome depends critically on the attitude of the Iranian army. And the Iranian army trusts American army generals, but the Iranian army has been engaged in a conflict with the Iranian Air Force. And Dutch Heiser is an Air Force general, and he will not be able effectively to communicate with Army generals. I don't know whether there is an appropriate Army general, but I know that an Air Force general is wrong. Well, Carter, about that point, began to get edgy and made clear signs that the discussion and the interview was coming to an end. He said that he disagreed with me and that Heiser was going to go out there and so forth. Before the meeting, I had pretty well made up my mind that we had reached virtually the end, and that if the President, who was planning to depart for the Caribbean, had not taken clear and effective action to sustain the throne by the time that he departed for the Caribbean, that you might as well wash your hands of it. That was, I feel in retrospect, to be remiss, because I had counted more on Jordan to carry that message for me, which he had promised to do, and that because he procrastinated, that the message had not gotten through in early December, or actually mid-November, when it should have gotten through, and that by the time I actually had been encouraged to go to the President myself, it was really pretty much too late. My view of the matter is that by September, the Shah was in some degree of trouble with the Abadan fire, but there still probably was a 30% chance of saving him. 70% chance of saving him. 30% chance he was going down the tubes. By the time of martial law, that may have slipped to as low as 50-50 that he could survive. By December, the chances of saving him kept shrinking. By the end of December, I didn't think that the chances were better than 25 or 30%, and early in January they had fallen still more. When it was clear that the Shah was leaving the country, this is something that I mentioned to the President, if the Shah leaves the country and the army is cut adrift, that the army will disintegrate. It will not support Barzagan. There is no way of holding the thing together under those circumstances. My analysis of what was going on in Iran, I think, was quite correct. My ability to appreciate what was going on in the president's head was much less notable. So that, as far as I'm concerned, that was early in January. It may have been 7th or 8th of January. It may have been earlier. What was the place that Carter was going down in?
Guadalupe.
Yes, the Guadalupe meeting. I figured that if he ever left for Guadalupe, it was all over at the time. Well, it run out. And I left that meeting convinced that it was all over. I should say that I, as I ran around from person to person in November and December, attempting to get interest in what I regarded as one of the critical geopolitical developments in the post World War II development, this being as insignificant in some sense as the shift of China, or almost as significant as the shift of China in 1949, I felt myself more frustrated in Washington than I had at any other time. Now, after I left the president in whatever it was, January 6th or 7th, I had pretty well written it off. I decided that he was going to Guadalupe and that Bashar was coming out and that the capacity of the Iranian army to stand its ground would immediately disappear and that the army would disintegrate as a way of keeping all power from going to Khomeini. I mention this because I had been, I think, Brzezinski's principal ally in these debates, but by that time I decided it was all over, and I pretty well withdrew from further discussions of Iranian policy. Brzezinski went on and occasionally kept me informed about his various hopes, which I regarded as quixotic. Once the Shah was gone, the notion that you were going to have some kind of military coalescence that would result in a military overthrow or military takeover, the Iron Fist, might have been employed in November. There was no Iron Fist to be employed in late January or early February, and Dutch Heiser was not the man to pull it off. And I decided that early in January, as I indicated, was all over. Now, Brzezinski, who was at least more persistent than I, was still attempting some of these schemes a month and a half later.
Now, in terms of your original proposal to send a special representative to the Shah to talk him up, was it your sense that this would be a way to get him to impose Iron Fist strategy, say in November or early December?
Yeah. As you want to put it in those crude terms, I'll answer very simply. Yeah. You say the Shah was doing everything wrong. The Shah was doing everything wrong in that time frame. On Monday, his troops would shoot down some people in the streets, and on Tuesday he would come forward and beg the forgiveness of the populace. And on Wednesday, another incident would occur, and this wobbling was conveying to the Iranian public that his authority was really gone, and that you couldn't wobble under those circumstances. You had to have a consistent policy. Now, I was not, mind you, I was not suggesting that the army indiscriminately fire into mobs and the like. Because that would have been almost as bad as the wobbling policy. But we knew who the ringleaders were in the country. There were 400 or 500 of them. They could have been rounded up, which brings me to the whole discussion of Khomeini and Paris and the like. We could have rounded them up. We could have arranged for the termination of Khomeini's communications with Iran. All of that could have been done. All of that could have been attempted. And it might indeed have been crowned with success. Mind you, by this time I thought that the probability of success had fallen to below 50-50. But it could well have been crowned with success. I should say, in passing, that I never shared the hopes or illusions of several in the administration that Khomeini was going to be, that we would be able to work with Khomeini. He struck me as a fanatic, indeed, strikes me as a fanatic. At one of our meetings, we had an intelligence briefing from Admiral Turner in which he talked about the post-takeover evolution of Khomeini towards moderation, and I told Brzezinski even more forcefully that that was absolutely preposterous. Khomeini was hopelessly anti-American and hopelessly anti-West, with the notion that this fanatic was going to become a regular politician once in power was misguided. But in any event, what was I on before this?
Well, what the Shah could have done, given you.
Oh, yeah, I was talking about the cutting off the communications and rounding up the ringleaders and so on, that there was a great deal of power, and that once you had done this, that there was a very large probability that you would not have been turning out the mobs that were very well organized and the like, that the sole opportunity at that stage of preserving the throne was to take care of the ringleaders. Now, you understand that under circumstances of that sort, with the demonstration of power of that sort, that the Iranian population might have done what it traditionally does, which is decide with the winner who might well be defined. But that, whether that was right or wrong, that was the notion that I had in my mind. And that the Shah would have to be encouraged, because he was by nature indecisive. And in addition, he had perceived the ambivalence of American policy, and that he was not sure that he would be backed up by the United States. That's why you had to have a high-level representative known to be close to the president to bring him to the state. Now, what was wrong with that view? In retrospect, it's plain that the Shah was sufficiently sick that he probably could not have carried it out.
Well, Rich, six points. I have the impression that despite his illness, he considered a policy of greater repression after a certain point, but that he thought that the troops weren't loyal enough to carry it out. He was afraid there might be a military rebellion if he had a policy of repression.
This was a continuing concern of mine, because you could see, as you read the daily take from the country, you could see that what had initially been very faithful forces were eroding in their loyalties, that their capacity to deal with the crowd, that there were desertions and so forth, and that the military was a wasting asset, particularly the enlisted personnel. What might have worked in November, when martial law was first established, or when I wanted somebody to go out there, might very well not have worked at all in December. Now, you could have rounded up the ringleaders, and you could have cut off Khomeini's communications. And if you had done so, the street actions might well have eroded.
You analyze revolution basically in terms of the ringleaders or more fundamental social problems. How did you analyze it to begin with, I guess?
Well, I think that we can talk about what my analysis was of Iran, or what my analysis is of revolutions, because the revolutionary fervor is more evident in retrospect than it was at the time. My view of revolutions is pretty well summarized by De Tocqueville or by Cranford in his Anatomy of Revolution. It is, amongst other things, it is wobbling on the part of the authorities that incompetence and wobbling on the part of the authorities that permits the conflagration of revolutionary sentiment to feed on itself. There was no question that the Shah had sufficient instruments of power to the roundup of these ringleaders. Now you ask, in retrospect, am I convinced that this would have worked? And I said, no. I wasn't even convinced at the time of the work. I thought that we had a chance. I knew that the outcome, if Khomeini took over, was going to be a disaster for the United States. A disaster not only in Iran, but elsewhere in the Middle East, because our stock would fall. And that it was well worth the chance. If I had believed with Admiral Turner and others that Khomeini might turn out to be a moderate with whom we could work, somebody who we could work even though immoderate, then the risks might have been greater than the possible benefits. But I didn't believe that. I thought that it was going to be a dead loss. And while one's analysis of the circumstances may have been wrong in retrospect on the fact that Khomeini was going to be anti-Western and a dead loss from our standpoint, that's turned out to be directly right. Now, with regard to Khomeini, Khomeini was sitting there in a Parisian suburb making use of French telecommunications. He was taping cassettes by the dozen, and that these were being shipped out there, being reproduced by the hundreds, and inflaming the country. That could have been terminated, and that could have been terminated early on.
These alternatives discussed, the National Security Council.
I was just about to come to that, or about to come to that issue. No, these things weren't really discussed in the National Security Council, because I pointed out to you earlier that there was kind of just a basic division within the administration, which Carter had not resolved, or had not resolved at that point. He was drifting towards the Brzezinski view of the world, but he didn't quite embrace it. And he didn't quite say, we're not going state's way. If he'd said we're going state's way, that would have been fine. Well, not fine from my standpoint, but it would have been better administration. But these meetings tended to be polite exchanges, which save on rare occasions in which we agreed on tactical measures, did not bridge the basic analytical differences about what to do, whether he was supporting the Shah or replacing the Shah. The state people tended to take the view that the Shah must go, and they used the Council of Notables, etc. We tended to take the view that the throne must be sustained, and that probably, though not positively, not that the Shah had to be supported. Certainly meant that you have to arrange a very nice transition to his son taking over, which had certain advantages. So that didn't come up in those discussions. As I mentioned to you, however, I had been to China. And one of the things the Chinese were doing was planning to build a couple of nuclear plants. nuclear plants were Framatome plants, Framatome being the principal French constructor of Endor nuclear plants, and they used Westinghouse's design, Secretary of Energy, its successor to the Atomic Energy, would give the authority whether or not those designs could be used for transfer to some third party. So I had a visit shortly after my return from the French ambassador. And we chatted a bit, politely, talked about China. And we made official requests that look favorably on authorizing Framatome to use Westinghouse's designs. And I said that there shouldn't be much problem about that. I wasn't that much worried about commercial plans and so on. And he seemed much relieved. I said, but there's something of much greater importance, Mr. Ambassador. And that is, you are harboring in Paris, the man who is in the process of bringing down the Shah of Iran. Why don't you curb him? Why do you allow him full access to communications? Why do you allow these insurrectionary stuff to go out of France? And he said to me, we have had no request from the Shah bring extraordinary measures to bear. Indeed, we asked the Shah what he wanted to do, and he said, let him alone. Which stunned me at the time. Stunned me at the time. Shah had so underrated the problem. Shah had been busy kind of making his problem worse because he had now put him in the center of a center of Western communications. But the Shah had taken no action to still Khomeini's voice. The French government, which was quite capable of taking vigorous action, there's no country that's better at that kind of thing than the French, and a breakdown of French telephonic communications, Monsieur Khomeini, you know, you must know how regretful we are of these developments. The French were perfectly within their rights. The Shah had not made any request. I was stunned by that. If there had been action early on to isolate Khomeini, not to make him a martyr, mind you, but simply to cut off communication, as well as a rounding up of the ringleaders, we might well have had a better outcome. Now, academics, liberals, all sorts, more than academics and liberals, express doubt about this. They believe, as your prior question suggested, that these things are uncontrollable once they get started. That is the application of splendid hindsight. And just to underscore these possibilities, let me point out what developed in Poland subsequently. Jaruzelski declared martial law, either rounded up the leaders or drove them underground, took over communications. He effectively cut off Solidarity that had the overwhelming support of the Polish people. There is a tendency on the part of many here in the United States to underestimate the power of the instruments of authority and overestimate the zeal and persistency of supposedly mass movements. Quite frequently, when the leaders are taken away, their followers are mill around because they're leaderless or just disappear. That has been the prior history in Iran. It certainly was what happened to the Shah as he left in 1952 or 53, and when Mossadegh left in 53, bang, crowd is with the apparent winner. And part of the reason that the Shah was getting into greater and greater trouble was that there were increasing and legitimate doubts that he was a winner.
You were saying earlier that you compared the Iranian Revolution and its significance with the revolution in China in 49. Now, when you were thinking about these things in 78, what were your apprehensions about the impact of the revolution?
Well, I didn't think of that kind of parallel because I did not think of the forces at play as those of unconquerable revolution. Unavoidable revolution, and one thought of the instruments of authority available to the Shah is much greater than in China, and that the military instruments that Mao Zedong had were simply not available to Khomeini. It was, after all, a military victory of the communists in China over Chiang Kai-shek. There were no military forces, so this was a question of dealing with public sentiments for which the Shah had become increasingly ill-equipped, as it were, to deal effectively. My apprehensions were first of enhanced and greater instability in the oil markets, which was my nominal area of responsibility, but I was much more concerned about the geopolitical position of the United States in the region. With the Shah, for all the reasons that we had laid out, going back to the early 1970s, was the central figure, the linchpin of the American position in the region, and that we could not allow him fall without destroying, as it were, our position in the region, our image in the region, and it caused damage to that amongst the Arabs, Saudis, and others. And moreover, that I suspected at the time that the successor arrangement in Iran was going to be of a fragmented, divided authority. I did not imagine at the time, I did not imagine even well into 1979 when I was testifying on these matters before the Senate. I did not imagine that the Khomeini would be able to establish and retain the absolute control over the outlying parts of the country, and that there was going to be a free field for the Soviets to play in, either by possibly snipping off pieces of the country, but by kind of general destruction. Those were my apprehensions at the time, that we would lose a major asset, that the collapse of the Cento, in which the Shah was critical, meant that this belt, security belt that we had established and supported with greater or lesser enthusiasm since the 1950s, 50s, but that security belt would be hopelessly shattered. And that belt, the northern tier, had been established in a way to prevent southward movement of the Soviets toward the Indian Ocean. I feared that all of that might take place. Indeed, many of these fears were expressed when I left the Department of Energy in my farewell remarks, but they had been expressed 7 months earlier, as I recall it, in a speech that I gave in London to the Pilgrims on the occasion, more or less, of the Thanksgiving anniversary. The Pilgrims in London do celebrate Thanksgiving. I've given a speech in which I talked of the geopolitical situation in Iraq, in the Middle East, in the light of the threats to the Shah's continuation in office. And I held out some dire predictions with regard to the consequences of the fall, though I was not as publicly pessimistic about his chances of survival as the reality might have required.
Now you mentioned earlier about Fritz Kramer's warning that the Shah was in mortal danger. That was in the spring of 78.
March of 78, if I recall.
Except for that, it seems like the revolution took most intelligence officials, policymakers, by great surprise. Why do you think?
Be very careful about that. Policymakers by surprise, yeah, more than intelligence officials.
Yeah.
Because from the early fall, I would get Burgos to bring over people from the CIA to brief me, and it was plain that down there at the bottom that they took a view much less sanguine than was being expressed officially by the intelligence agencies. I think that it was simply a failure of intelligence. Why do I say that? I think there's a failure of intelligence, not because of the usual things that it's ascribed to, that the Shah wouldn't let us speak to dissident groups within the country, that we had agreed as a consequence of being in country and having those facilities up on the north border, not to fiddle around with dissidents, but to take the official path. That's not what I'm referring to, because that indeed may have been a condition of our being in country. The fact of the matter was that most intelligence agencies around the world, including the most significantly the Israeli intelligence, had concluded that the Shah was on the skids by the middle of 1978. The British took a more pessimistic view, a far more pessimistic view than we did, and that we were simply not disregarding or not inquiring as to the attitude of our sister intelligence agencies, some of which were better qualified to make those judgments than we were. We were not sufficiently modest to recognize that, perhaps. But, you know, the Israelis depended upon the Shah for their oil. And they took an even greater interest in the well-being of the Shah than we did. But we did not take into account, I doubt that we really absorbed and attempted to absorb the attitudes of other intelligence agencies allied to us with an equal interest in the country. And therefore, I think that the intelligence failure is simply that Fritz Kramer, as many may know, is given to, a kind of dramatic and stark pessimism, and the times that Fritz sent that letter to me with a number of cables attached, I thought that the Shah was indeed incons- considerable trouble. But the letter said, "Sir, the Shah is in mortal peril." Mortal peril struck me as a Cranmerian overstatement. But that the indulgent attitude that was taken by American intelligence up until the time of the Abadan fire, indeed beyond the Abadan fire, was wholly unwarranted. Even though one might not agree with Kramer's immediate and intuitive judgments of this sort, intelligence communities don't make those kinds, or at least our intelligence community does not make an intuitive judgment. They look for hard evidence, as they put it. Intuitive people like Kramer and those agencies that have fewer resources and have to depend upon shreds of information and plus intuition are in a position to make those judgments, and those intuitions happened in that case to have been far sounder than any of the hard take that we were getting.
Now, earlier you said that there was a bit of clarity of policy between what you suggested, and what the State Department, there was a conflict in the State Department position, your position.
Yeah, there's a basic difference in approach.
Yeah.
I have raised questions about the appropriateness of the approach of Brzezinski and myself. Even more so because Brzezinski went on and on in January and February when I thought it becomes quite irrelevant. The reason that I stressed the inappropriateness in retrospect was that none of us had knowledge of indeed, to borrow Kramer's phrase, that the Shah was in mortal peril from cancer, and that therefore might be physically and psychologically in no position to carry off the actions that the history imposed upon him under those circumstances.
But given those alternatives, you suggest that the Carter did not make a choice.
Oh, yeah.
Do you have a sense of why that was the case? Why you did not decide on a policy? Or you get any kind of a hint to the divisor as to what was,
well,
what the Boston choice was?
Carter's propensity was to let things sort themselves out so quickly. Carter tended to believe in reconciliation, if I can put it that way. In negotiations, you put Sadat and Begin into the same room, and they hammer out the reconciliation of sorts. You put energy and environment in the same room, and they hammer out the reconciliation. He was a believer in consensus. It's the way, in part, that he succeeded as governor of Georgia, or he felt he succeeded. And he applied these techniques on the international scene to groups and nations that, to which they were inapplicable. He thought that people could hammer out their differences, and that no differences were so irreconcilable. And therefore, the thing to do was to let people mill around, and that sooner or later they would bridge their differences. It happened to be a deeply felt faith with Carter, I think, that it comes sort of out of his Sunday school tradition, that people of different views, through extensive discussion, would ultimately come to a measure of agreement. That was part of it. More on that point, and parallel to it, is Jimmy Carter had the deficiency, in my judgment, in understanding that he did not understand when there was a hopeless logical contradiction. Carter was a detail man. He never did quite get an overview. And if he had more of a capacity for overview, he would say, what I'm hearing from these fellows and what I'm hearing from these fellows simply irreconcilable, that I'm going to have to decide. He didn't believe in logical irreconcilability. So I think that that's it. Also, as I mentioned, Carter was himself preoccupied with the normalization of China. Throughout this period, the process of the SALT II negotiations were far more important to the United States government. He was paying less attention to it. As I say, when I visited him early in January, just prior to the visit of Guadeloupe, it was plain that Guadeloupe was much more on his mind than was the development. He gave me a little speech on what was going to happen down in Guadeloupe at the outset of our discussion. It was plainly much more on his mind than what was happening in Iran. So he may not have felt it necessary to focus on it, as well as that Carter had great difficulty in saying these positions are really irreconcilable. It was true inside the country. And he did not understand, in my judgment at least, that there were irreconcilable positions within the country and that they could not be straddled by a Barzagar or, for that matter, by a council of elders, a council of notables, that either the throne was going to be sustained by the army, or Khomeini was going to take over, and that you didn't have other alternatives.
I don't think I have any more questions unless you have concluding remarks you want to make.
I don't know that I have.
No.
I don't know that I have any concluding remarks. It may well be true, though I did not think of it at the time and still had doubts about it, that this was a hurricane of revolutionary force that was not going to be suppressed by any measures. That is not my reading in general of lesser states that have been leaned upon by great powers, particularly Iran. While it is less plausible that the Shah had the fortitude to pull these things off given his illness, and it is less plausible the outcome in Iran, which you cannot foresee in advance. Everything in retrospect looks inevitable. The British historian Maitland said, something to the effect that in looking back we see so many things that are inevitable that as we look to the actual development at the time seem to the parties quite avoidable, and I think that should govern our view of these kinds of developments. And I'm pretty sure you cited a Jaruzelski Poland, but the Soviet thumb on Poland is clearly much greater than the American thumb on Iran at any time, including 1953. So one should not think of the outcome as inevitable or foreordained. So I can get that phrase from me. In retrospect, aspect, I think, that the fact that the martial law that was declared on November the 6th was so visible a failure should have told us that the Shah didn't have what was needed. He didn't have the will or the insight to control the situation. And that is a consequence of that failure that the thing was pretty hopeless. And that the United States indeed should have moved, if you could imagine, a compromised position between what Brzezinski was saying and what the state people in Paul was saying. But we should have moved early, we should have obtained the knowledge about the Shah's cancer. We should have moved early to replace the Shah with his son. That he could no longer hold, that the replacement of the Shah might have reflected the anger of some of the groups that had traditionally supported the monarchy or had good reason to support the monarchy. I refer particularly to the middle class and to the bazaar. And that there might have been a wave of enthusiasm for the replacement, particularly if you had taken the ringleaders away just prior to that and had limited Khomeini's communications with the country. But that the Shah himself couldn't pull it off any longer. And that we probably should have recognized that in late November, early December, as the results of martial law, partly through the Shah's era of choice, and partly through the Shah's ambivalence about martial law, that the Shah didn't have it, that indeed that he had to be replaced, not by the Council of Elders stuff, the Council of Nobles, although that might have been a useful answer. One would have had to make the new young Shah central to the hopes and to have him give some speeches that would have stirred hope for the regime and that might have calmed the streets. In retrospect, I think that is the only hope to have it all. As to my own role, I regret that I was sufficiently so preoccupied with other matters that I was unable seriously to get engaged until it was almost too late, if not too late. It was plain that the Shah was getting into increasing trouble in the summer. By the summer, he was in trouble with the fall. I followed the intelligence with some interest, but I never got involved seriously. And the Shah would have benefited from some very clear guidance from the United States early on. He always felt that the United States was ambivalent. The United States was ambivalent. He was right. That in the spring, I think that the kinds of gestures that were made in December, January of 78-9, attempts to transform the regime, to make it more open, to restore the Constitution of 1906 and so forth, in the spring, well before you had all of the events that followed from Abadan, that reconciliation rather than the iron fist might have worked. By the fall, it was too late because the public had the bit.
But even if the Shah conceived of it, even if he announced that sick, would he perceive the speeding power? Would that have been something that he was able to, would the Shah been able to, even if he had been healthy, was he the kind of a person who had ceded power under those circumstances?
Very, very doubtful. He would have had to be pressed very hard by the Americans. But you see, the Shah, who could be so opinionated and arrogant when there was no trouble, was a very indecisive man in the face of adversity. He had to be carried through in 1953 by the Americans. And throughout 1978, he was looking for guidance. And I think that it is at least plausible that if he had taken a very firm line, such as, Your Majesty, you've got two choices. Strength. Restore the Constitution, all the marvelous. Make yourself, in effect, the leader of the establishment of a limited monarchy, or alternatively, you would then have to sooner or later crack down, and that he cannot pussyfoot, so that he might well have taken the advice. The great Marxists like Plekhanov, tells us that it's social events rather than individuals that make history, that social events form the individuals. And one can argue on behalf of Plekhanov and his views of that subject that both the United States and Iran were in that crisis, plagued by indecision and by leaders that they wanted it both ways. And more decisive figures would be both ways.
Okay. Thank you very much for your time. Sorry about those problems with